From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention held a press briefing and said it's not a question of if COVID-19 will spread in the U.S., it's a question of when. And by the way, we're taking your COVID-19 questions at hearandnow.org. We'll get them answered in the coming days. But meanwhile, CDC officials say their thinking is partly based on the way COVID-19 is spreading around the world, where there are now more than 80,000 people infected. Croatia and Austria reported their first cases today. Their neighbor Italy has more than 200. The BBC's Bethany Bell is in Milan. And Bethany, this is a packed city. We also understand that towns in that area are sealed off. What's going on?
Well, yes, as you say, Milan is an enormous city in Italy. It's the heart of Italy's economic wealth, if you like. The place is a little bit southeast of here. There's a region where a group of towns has been put in quarantine, another couple closer to Venice as well, which is a much smaller area. It's affecting about 50,000 people. Mm. And that's where the initial spike of infections happened. I've just returned from that area, and you could see the police were setting up checkpoints, and they wouldn't let people pass in or come out unless they had very special permission. And if they did try and come out, they face fines.
Wow. Well, do we know why this particular area is seeing the spike? In other words, have they found the ground zero patient so that they can know what people might have come in contact with that patient and may have the virus but not have symptoms? I mean, you know, that critical part of figuring this out, do they know that information?
They still haven't figured out who patient zero was in this region. They're trying to do that still. They're working on it. But there has been this increase in infections around there. And they are now, that was why they decided to impose these quarantine measures in an attempt to try and keep it down. Small businesses are closed down. Cafes are closed down. You know, you think of Italy and its coffee culture. The coffee bars in little towns have been closed by order of the authorities in order not to to try and stop the spread of the disease. And even in other places where the cafes and restaurants are still open, everything's a bit subdued. People aren't going out as much. And there is this sense of uncertainty here, people just not knowing what to expect.
Well, especially since, at least in some other areas, I mean, we spoke yesterday about a county here in the United States, they know that, you know, people have traveled home from China. So there's a way of sort of, you know, telling people to monitor themselves, or then if people have symptoms, telling them to quarantine. You're saying that there's absolutely no clue as to how this got there.
The authorities say they haven't traced it yet.
Yeah.
And it should be said that, you know, there have been a number of cases now reported here in Italy. Those who have died have been people, there have been 7 confirmed deaths here in Italy. They have been people who in general have been in their 80s, people with health conditions, you know, that they needed to take care of before of that. So it's a complicated picture at the moment. Mm. And I think that's the thing that most people can't figure out, is that, is this something which is going to prove to have tremendous mortality, or is this something that will be a little bit like a bad influenza? People don't know.
Right. Well, without a vaccine, an influenza can kill, as we, you know, as we
of
know,
course it can
wipe
of
out.
Of course it
right.
can, and right. influenza does kill.
Right.
And yet people don't have the same fear. This is it's the unknown, I think, that is really freaking people out here.
Yeah. Is there a sense that the government is doing enough, that the healthcare system can cope? Because, you know, these kinds of things are exponential, you know, they grow. So do people feel confident?
People feel insecure. And again, it depends on who you speak to. Some people feel confident, some people don't. I was speaking yesterday to a young girl who is a student at the University of Trento, which is quite a long way away from this area around Milan. But her university has been closed. Universities across northern Italy have closed down. Schools have closed down. So there is this sort of rather weird feeling going on. People, today is Mardi Gras, it's Shrove Tuesday. This is the day that the Venice Carnival, which is that big celebration where people dress up in masks and everything, that's not taking place this year.
The BBC's Bethany Bell in Milan, in northern Italy, as that country reacts to upwards of 200 cases of COVID-19 and, as Bethany just said, 7 or so deaths. Bethany, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, turning to politics now, Super Tuesday is a week from today. That is the day when 14 states will hold their presidential primaries, including California and Texas. We've been checking in with reporters in a number of Super Tuesday states, and today we're going to look at Texas, which will offer up more than 200 delegates. For more, we're joined by KUT reporter Ashley Lopez in Austin. Hi, Ashley.
Hey.
So the latest polls show Bernie Sanders with a slight lead. Here he was in San Antonio over the weekend.
You know, based on what I have seen today in Texas, we were in El Paso, we're here now. Don't tell anybody. I don't want to get them nervous. We are going to win the Democratic primary in Texas.
But former Vice President Joe Biden and Mike Bloomberg are right behind him in the latest poll. Ashley, what do we know about the state of the race right now, and what are you hearing?
You know, Texas likes to think it's pretty exceptional, but anything that kind of happens in the national contest seems to bear out in Texas. So, you know, when Biden seemed to have a lead, you know, nationally, Texas had like a lot of support for Vice President Biden, too. So now that there's been this surge in the first few nominating contests for Bernie Sanders, like, that's been bearing out in the polls here in Texas. But this is a weird place because 2018 was the first time that the Democrats here in Texas actually had a pretty good showing in statewide elections. They didn't win, but it was enough to sort of excite Democratic voters. So I think there's going to be like a lot of new voters. Early voting is up in at least the 10 biggest counties here. So it's hard to predict what's going to happen. But for the most part, polls seem to show that whatever's happening nationally is also happening in Texas.
Now, Sanders is coming off momentum from the Nevada caucuses where he performed well with Latino voters. Does he have strong Latino support in Texas?
It's hard to tell as well. Like, there's not a lot of good polling of Latino voters in Texas specifically. And, you know, I have seen some polling targeted at Latinos, and it has to do mostly with whether they feel like campaigns have effectively engaged with them. And especially if you're like a young Latino, Latinos under 30, a lot of them have said that they haven't heard at all from campaigns. Like, they're just not a constituency that has voted very predictably in the past. Mm-hmm. So, like, campaigns don't spend a lot of money there. So, again, that's like another wild card. The Latino vote is big and growing, but like usually very untapped in Texas.
Senator Elizabeth Warren has been trailing in the polls in Texas, but she has been campaigning with Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio and former cabinet secretary under President Obama. Will his endorsement help her in the state of Texas?
Yeah, that's also hard to tell because he was running for president and he didn't. And then the polls here in Texas, he wasn't doing very well either. So, you know, even when he was the candidate himself, even though he's from Texas, that didn't seem to help him in Texas. It's hard to tell whether endorsements seem to matter as much as they used to. But, you know, as far as like Julian Castro's sort of cachet here, that's also kind of hard to tell.
By the way, Beto O'Rourke has not made an endorsement so far in this primary, right?
No, he hasn't.
The former New York City mayor, Michael Bloomberg, is polling behind Sanders. How effective has his strategy been in Texas? Have you been seeing a lot of his ads?
I mean, I think it's hard not to see a Bloomberg ad in Texas, at least since like late December. We've been seeing a couple trickle in, but now it's like you can't turn on, you know, almost any video platform like YouTube, Hulu or something. And then the TV on every station, like you'll pretty much run into a Bloomberg ad. And it has been working. You know, I think he started in like a single digits here in the polls. And then by the end of February, like right before the caucuses, he was pretty much neck and neck with Joe Biden here. Those ads have worked. Now, it hasn't been enough for him to like have more support than, you know, say Sanders right now, but it has made a dent.
One more thing I want to ask you about. There's another race on the ballot in Texas for the Democrats, and that is the race to run against Republican U.S. Senator John Cornyn, who is up in the fall. There are 12 Democrats vying in this race. Who's doing well in that primary, and is that likely to be a competitive race in the fall?
Yeah, I mean, the primary race will definitely end in a runoff. It is very crowded, as you mentioned. And not one candidate has overwhelming support, but the sort of front runners right now are MJ Hager, who ran for John Carter's seat. It was a very Republican-leaning seat that she lost by only about, I think, like less than 3 percentage points. So she made a big showing in that seat, and now she's running for the U.S. Senate. She seems to be the front runner. And then right behind her is Cristina Sinsun Ramirez, who's gotten a lot of endorsements recently, notably Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And then there's Royce West, who's been in the state Senate for a very long time. He's well known in the Dallas area, and a Houston councilwoman, Amanda Edwards. So like whoever like the top two people will be, this will definitely end in a runoff. And then like the general election comes, like what that's going to look like is a very good question. Cause I mean, MJ Hager is a little more moderate, and then Cristina Sinsun Ramirez is like kind of like AOC, like a very progressive candidate. And so like the contours of that race will look very different depending who comes out on top after the runoff in May.
That is Ashley Lopez, reporter at KUT in Austin, Texas. Texas votes on Super Tuesday. Ashley, thanks.
Thank you.
And before we get to Super Tuesday, there's South Carolina this Saturday. Here and Now's Tanya Mosley will be broadcasting from South Carolina later this week.
Each of us is the star in the movie of our life. But how much of a role do we play in other people's movies?
It was a really sort of palpable fear that they were going to reject me or worse.
The unseen pressures we place on other people. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
President Trump's longtime friend Roger Stone is back in court today trying to convince the judge who sentenced him last week to 40 months in prison that he deserves a new trial. You'll remember the sentence originally recommended by prosecutors was 7 to 9 years. President Trump tweeted out his displeasure. Attorney General William Barr intervened to ask for a lower sentence. Now, Barr denied it was under pressure from the president, but then went on to complain about Twitter pressure from the president. After Barr's intervention, more than 2,000 former Department of Justice officials called on him to resign for flouting, they said, the principles in their own justice manual, that the Department of Justice must be impartial and insulated from political influence. Which got us wondering, just why was the Department of Justice created, and when? We know at the country's birth there was a lot of corruption. One role of the department was to ensure lawyers across the country had the same standard. But for more, let's bring in Robert Kazurowski. He's law professor at Fordham University Law School. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And we understand that it was the Judiciary Act of 1789, country well underway, that established what was called a federal justice system. It had a Supreme Court and a post for the Attorney General, but no department. So tell us more about these beginnings.
It's not until 1870 that the legal business of the United States is centered in the Department of Justice, which is created in 1870, in part to centralize the Attorney General's efforts to enforce the Reconstruction Amendments, which really changes the constitutional structure of the United States by delegating to Congress the power to enforce what we think of as fundamental rights of citizens.
You mentioned Reconstruction. This was post-Civil War, and there was a thinking that
That's right. Yeah,
a lot of people in positions of power were not sympathetic to the idea of Reconstruction and civil rights for former slaves. And so the Department of Justice, this is one theory, was created to help deal with, you know, a lot of litigation that was going to come at the end of the Civil War.
That's right. The primary business of the Department of Justice when it's created is enforcing the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts that Congress enacted to implement those Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And that effort is short-lived because, as you say, there were a lot of people opposed to this. And by the 1880s, the federal government is not doing much in enforcing those rights. And it's not until the 1960s that the Department of Justice in the Kennedy and then the Lyndon Johnson administrations put the power of the Department of Justice behind the enforcement of the civil rights and voting rights of African Americans.
So this was a heroic time for the DOJ, but what were the questions?
Yes.
I mean, here's the president's brother as the Department of Justice. What
That's
happened
right.
because of that?
Bobby Kennedy is an advisor of John Kennedy, and it's Bobby Kennedy who is the primary motivator in the Kennedy administration's support for civil rights. And it's Bobby Kennedy who sends Nicholas Katzenbach, the deputy attorney general, down to Alabama to force the desegregation of the University of Alabama in 1962 or 63. So there's a very close connection between the Department of Justice headed by Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy. That changes when Kennedy is assassinated and Lyndon Johnson becomes president. Bobby Kennedy and his successor, Nicholas Katzenbach, disliked LBJ, and LBJ disliked them. And so they operated more independently of the president than did Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, and even people who thought that what Bobby Kennedy was doing was good work in enforcing civil rights, there were nepotism laws passed after that, weren't there?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Well, now bring us up to another relationship. President Nixon and Attorney General John Mitchell, who helped direct the DOJ resources to fight Nixon's political enemies. He fought personal battles on behalf of the president. Nixon resigned before he could be impeached. Mitchell served jail time. Some are holding this up as demonstrating that there are limits to what can be tolerated between a president and an attorney general. Can you look at that through today's prism? When we have President Trump saying he has the right to tell the DOJ to do whatever he wants.
That's right. As a result of that incident, a number of statutes were enacted by Congress to separate the attorney general's independence from the control of the president. And one of the important reforms that Congress enacted in 1978 was the Ethics in Government Act, which created the Independent Counsel, establishing an officer outside of the Department of Justice to investigate wrongdoing within the administration. Now, there is a connection between what Mitchell was doing and what Barr is doing today. The misuse of government agencies to investigate political opponents and so forth in the Nixon administration is very similar to what Barr is doing with the Department of Justice today, in that Barr is using the power of the Department of Justice to benefit the political interests of the president. The difference, however, between what Mitchell was doing and what Barr is doing is that Barr is interfering directly in cases involving friends of the president, as well as preventing evidence from being presented to Congress that reveal President Trump's wrongdoing. What Barr is doing is truly an abuse of power. It's unethical, and it violates the norms that were established in the post-Watergate era.
Well, but you know, William Barr is a proponent of what's called the unitary executive. This is an executive branch entirely under the president's control. And the president says he's the chief law enforcement officer, that the DOJ is under the executive branch. And therefore, this unitary executive theory applies.
So the unitary executive theory is a theory that evolved in the 1980s with conservative Republicans and the Federalist Society. The critical point in the unitary executive theory that's most problematic is the idea that the president may do whatever the president wants. John Yoo, as a member of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Bush 43 administration, was one of the primary drafters of the torture memorandum, if you recall that. Mm-hmm. And he asserted that unitary executive theory in arguing that the president has the authority to order enhanced interrogation and is able to exercise his powers without oversight of the courts or the Congress. In terms of the case law, the Supreme Court, all the way back to Nixon in United States versus Nixon, where President Nixon's attorney argued that the president has absolute executive privilege. The court rejected that idea. And consistently since then, whenever the president has asserted an unreviewable power, the Supreme Court has rejected it. Mm. And the traditions as well as the law gives Congress the power of oversight of the executive branch. And for the first time, President Trump is arguing that Congress does not have that oversight.
Well, it's interesting you say for the first time President Trump said that he had this right, because we remember that Richard Nixon, after he resigned the presidency, told David Frost in that famous interview, you know, when he was asked about using the FBI and the CIA to investigate his political opponents, he said, well, when the president does something, that means it's not illegal. And I'm wondering, you know, most people do agree there should be a firewall between politics and the justice system. But for these people who don't, who believe in the unitary executive, this, you know, all-powerful presidency, isn't it in the president's favor, the history we just outlined? There's no Department of Justice in the Constitution. The first attorney general was a part-time job that, you know, some person did, you know, a few, pushed some papers around. It's evolved over time. Can't they say we're evolving it again?
Yeah, and I stand corrected. You're absolutely right about Nixon making that assertion. And I also mentioned that Bush asserted it as well. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the question, it is a fact that the president is the chief law enforcement officer, in that it is Article 2 that delegates to the president the power faithfully to execute the law. However, our principle of separation of powers includes checks and balances. And that principle is as foundational as the idea that we have three branches of government. That's number one. Number two, there is such a thing as abuse of power, so that although the president has the power to enforce the laws, he does not have the power to enforce the laws in a way that are immoral, unethical, or indeed self-serving, as we see President Trump do today.
That's Professor Robert Kazurowski, law professor at Fordham University Law School. Professor, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Stock markets around the world were lower again today after dropping sharply yesterday on fears about the spread of the coronavirus. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hey, Jeremy.
So yesterday was a bad day for stocks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had its worst day in 2 years, falling about 3.5%. And today's not looking so great either. Should we be concerned?
I mean, look, a couple of extra beads of sweat, not so dumb during a time of general euphoria and rich market valuations. You look at China and Korea, they are critical to the global economy. Italy, which is now feeling the hit of the virus, is critical to Europe. Things can go wrong, so it's always smart to have cash or bonds on reserve.
It's almost surprising that it took investors this long to get this concerned about it.
That's right.
We're going to continue to watch that, but there is another big business story I want to ask you about today. Amazon is opening its first Amazon Go grocery store in Seattle. This is a grocery store with no cashiers or checkout lines, no self-checkout kiosks either. How does it work?
Yeah, the frictionless supermarket experience is holy grail-like if you follow the industry. The margins are so thin that you want to push labor to the customer and to automation. So in this case, you're picking up your cart, you check in with your phone, you fill the cart. And the Amazon Go stores, they're using a combination of overhead cameras and computer vision technology that's then paired with smartphone geofencing. It all hopefully works out. It's taken 3 or 4 years to iron out, and there are many bugs still. But hopefully you can walk in and out without a single human interaction, be that, you know, credit card, cash, no having to deal with anyone.
Well, and Amazon started launching small convenience stores like this 2 years ago using this technology. But this is much bigger. This is a big grocery store.
Yeah, I think it's not intended to compete with Whole Foods, which Amazon took out for $14 billion a few years back. If anything, it's the frictionless technology that they want to pilot and master, because the optionality on that it's hugely disruptive for the entire industry.
Not great for jobs, though.
No, but look, I mean, 7-Eleven has experimented with this. You've had Walmart and Costco. You look at autonomous driving and other strides in automation. A lot of these things are brutal yet inevitable.
They would also be getting a lot more data about customers, right?
Yeah, that data, of course, I mean, it's vital. Amazon, in its traditional .com infrastructure, it voraciously consumes it. And various you know, chiefly brick and mortar players. You look at Target, you look at Macy's. They use GPS to track you in the store. Coupon clicks with CVS and grocery affinity cards. I mean, that's already there. What's increasingly becoming controversial is how this information is sliced and diced and brokered.
You know, I said data, you said data. When I think data, I think of that kid from the Goonies. Although there was a question about how he pronounced his name too. What does Amazon ultimately want to do with this technology, Robin?
Look, Amazon is a $1 trillion-plus company that is not measured. We've talked about this before on retail profitability. It's not about same store sales. They're not fighting on the same plane with a Kroger or a Star Market or a Publix. They're looking to spread this technology across their other nascent brick and mortar brands and potentially to license it to other retailers. It's the side of Amazon that's decidedly tech concerned and infrastructure concerned much more than brick and mortar.
Do the machines check your ID in these stores if you want to buy alcohol?
I mean, there are a limited number of employees at each location to help clear the inevitable bottlenecks, not unlike the grocery style, you know, when you do self-checkout, one of which is ID presentation for alcohol. So that remains one of the things to have to iron out.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Tonight is the 10th Democratic presidential candidates debate and the final time seven candidates, Joe Biden, Michael Bloomberg, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Bernie Sanders, Tom Steyer, and Elizabeth Warren will be on stage together before the South Carolina primary this Saturday and before Super Tuesday next Tuesday. Joining us now is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Jeremy.
Okay, so this is going to be quite something to watch, I think, tonight. The thinking is that front runner Bernie Sanders is going to be the focus of many attacks tonight because he's now the front runner. Overnight, he released a list of how he plans to pay for proposals like Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. What's he going to be facing tonight?
Funny how that happens the day of a debate, so that you make sure you have your talking points down.
And nobody has any time to read them either and come up with responses.
Yeah, but that's going to be one of the lines of attack for those moderates who feel like they need to stop Bernie Sanders' momentum as he's heading into Super Tuesday. You know, Bernie Sanders did quite well in Nevada. That overwhelming victory, in particular with Latinos, was really eye-opening for a lot of people. I mean, he blew away the field with them. And when you look to Super Tuesday and start gaming things out, California and Texas have huge populations of Latinos. And if Bernie Sanders runs up the score with them the way he did in Nevada, there may be no catching him for a pledged delegate lead. So, you know, this is one place where some of those moderates, instead of focusing so much attention on Mike Bloomberg as they did last time, they may be looking at Bernie Sanders. Of course, Bloomberg is going to be right in the middle of things probably once again because he did not have a good debate last time. He even admits that, and he's got a lot to answer for on his record.
Sanders is facing criticism for praising Cuban dictator Fidel Castro. And on CNN last night, he doubled down.
He initiated a major literacy program. There was a lot of folks in Cuba at that point who were illiterate. And he formed the Literacy Brigade. You may read that. He went out and they helped people learn to read and write. You know what? I think teaching people to read and write is a good thing.
So, Domenico, leaving aside the fact that President Trump has said he fell in love with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, Sanders rejected the idea that his views on this are radical or extreme. How big of a problem is this kind of thing going to be for him, especially in attracting more moderate Democrats?
Well, there's kind of a glib thing that a lot of people say during campaigns, and that's if you're explaining, you're losing. And it's sort of one of these things that, you know, a lot of Sanders supporters get very annoyed when they hear people say, equating what Sanders believes to socialism. They say, hey, you got to explain that it's democratic socialism. Most Americans don't know the difference or make that distinction. There is certainly a difference between how Norway and Denmark, you know, conduct their societies and more along the lines of the economic philosophy of Bernie Sanders than, say, Venezuela or Nicaragua or something like that. So there are differences, but even being in that conversation is potentially problematic for a lot of center-right-leaning Democrats, and they're nervous in those districts, in those 40 districts plus that Democrats won in. They're nervous about running with Bernie Sanders on their ticket because of how gerrymandered these districts have been. You know, so Bernie Sanders is, you know, he's faced more scrutiny this time than in 2016, but he's about to have the dump truck backed up on him, you know, whether that's from these Democratic candidates or from President Trump, because the Republicans just have all this oppo ready to go. And this wasn't even oppo. This was something he said last night.
Mike Bloomberg has a lot on the line, as you said, tonight after that widely panned debate last week. Yesterday, the Bloomberg campaign released a digital ad using some of Sanders' own words on gun control against him. Listen.
In Vermont, until last 2 years ago, we had virtually no gun control legislation at all. And I represented that perspective.
So that's the ad that Bloomberg is putting out there. But what is at stake for Bloomberg tonight when he is not in a scripted format like an ad and has to actually respond, as he did last week, to the other candidates?
You know, I heard Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago, who was President Obama's chief of staff, and more importantly, from my perspective, ran the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee that helped get Democrats elected in 2006. He was talking about how annoyed he was watching the Democratic candidates not attack Bernie Sanders on guns at the last debate in Las Vegas, given that Las Vegas had been the site of a horrific mass shooting, in having to make Sanders answer for his positions on guns. Now, Sanders would say that what Bloomberg has put out there is out of context, that his views are far more progressive than he's making them out to be. But that is one area where he doesn't line up as progressively as the rest of his positions. The one issue that Bloomberg and some of the other moderates are going to have in attacking Sanders is that Sanders is very well liked within the Democratic among Democratic voters. I almost said Democratic Party. I don't know if that's true. But among Democratic voters, he is definitely probably the most liked person in this race. If you look at 538's average of favorability ratings, he was a plus 51, meaning, you know, more people liked him than disliked him by a very wide margin. You know, that's different in a general election, but that is the problem with trying to attack him personally, and by the way, on Medicare for All, his principal healthcare position, which is very popular among Democrats, not popular with the American general election electorate more broadly.
What about Joe Biden? He came in a very distant second in Nevada last weekend. He did not do well in Iowa or New Hampshire. He's saying he expects to do well in South Carolina. But is this state coming up this Saturday the last stand for Biden?
It's a must win. And his campaign will even admit to that. You know, there was a time when we were all saying, you know, he needs a big win. And now his campaign, especially looking at what Tom Steyer has done in the state, is saying a win is a win, because Steyer has spent $21 million in the state on ads targeting African-Americans in particular. And that is the key core group in South Carolina in a Democratic primary. In 2016, 61% of the Democratic electorate were black. And, you know, when you look at what Biden did in Nevada, he won African-Americans, but only narrowly over Sanders. And we're seeing polling where his, you know, advantage is slipping. He's only up a few points, it looks like. His team will take, it doesn't matter, a one-vote victory they feel like will propel them into Super Tuesday, because half of the states on Super Tuesday have significant black populations. But if Sanders is winning half of the black population compared to Biden, and Sanders is running up the score with Latinos, it's a very difficult place for Biden or anyone else to be in. And you think about Biden's you know, base of support. He promised he would do well with working class whites. That was taken off the table in Iowa and New Hampshire. He promised he would do well with diverse voters. He didn't do well with Latinos. He's doing still okay retaining support with African Americans. And that's as narrow as his base has gotten now.
What about Pete Buttigieg, Domenico? He came in first in Iowa, barely, second in New Hampshire, and then third in Nevada, but he did just get the endorsement of the state newspaper in South Carolina. What are you expecting from him tonight and going into this weekend?
Well, you know, Buttigieg has done very well with college-educated whites, but that's about it. He was had a chance in Nevada to show that he could expand his base and hasn't been able to do it. So unless he can show in South Carolina that he can have a surprising finish, it's going to be difficult to see where he fits in come Super Tuesday and whether or not he can actually, you know, be the pledged delegate leader to build a coalition big enough to do that.
We've also got Tom Steyer on the stage tonight, Elizabeth Warren, who really went on the attack last time. Do you expect her to do more of that tonight in the debate, attacking everybody but Sanders, or is she going to go after Sanders too?
I think she'd probably lay off Sanders compared to the rest of the field. She went after Sanders a little bit in that last debate. What her team says is they saw in the entrance polls in Nevada that people who said they decided in the last few days, she did very well with them. Mm-hmm. But because 3/4 of the vote was banked early, she didn't really have a chance to change the trajectory of how she would finish. So they're hoping that a forceful debate here in South Carolina can propel her not just into South Carolina and have a decent finish, but into some of those Super Tuesday states.
Domenico, do you think that it's possible that some candidates will drop out after South Carolina but before Super Tuesday?
I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at Amy Klobuchar in particular. She hasn't had great finishes other than the third place finish in New Hampshire, which was a good finish for her. She certainly can argue she's done better than expectations. She's raised a decent amount of money since New Hampshire. But, you know, how long do you go on and what is the rationale for your candidacy if you continue to finish in fourth, fifth or sixth place?
If Biden loses in South Carolina, you think he could drop out before Super Tuesday?
It's very possible. It's going to be a big crack up in the Democratic Party if he winds up losing Saturday.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next segment is about eating disorders. Not too graphic, but it still may be triggering for some. So here's a number if you need it. 800-931-2237. That's the National Eating Disorders Association. This is National Eating Disorders Awareness Week. We are aware that women and men both suffer these disorders, but so do members of the LGBTQ community. In fact, they may be more at risk and feel more alone. 24-year-old Zachary Whitney lives in Texas. We found him on Reddit, where he was searching for community as he struggles with his eating disorder. Hi, Zachary.
Hi.
So do you remember when you might have sat up straight and said, I think I have an eating disorder?
Well, it was never something that I was conscious about, right? So when I first got diagnosed with anorexia, I was 16 years old, and I thought I needed to lose more weight. Mm. And I want to say it kind of started out as orthorexia, which is like a obsession with health and fitness. I was running like 3 or 4 miles like every day. And so it's more of like an obsession about like counting calories mm-hmm. and exercising. And then it transitioned to anorexia when I was 16.
Did you feel external pressure to do this or was it all internal? And I say that because we're reading articles like one in The Guardian where a mother writes about her teenage son's obsession with looking like men's magazines. So were you feeling that kind of external pressure or was it from within?
It was more from within because it was something that I could control. My childhood was kind of chaotic, but it wasn't until I turned 16 and started getting really into fashion that's when I felt external pressure. My eating disorder stemmed from an obsession with wanting to look like a model, like male model, but a female model, because at the time I was struggling with my gender identity. I thought I wanted to transition into being a girl. And if I did, I would want to be a super thin girl, like a supermodel like Kate Moss or Naomi Campbell. Or that was another aspect of the eating disorder that was very much external for me.
Well, look, you know the statistics by now, I'm sure. This is very common in the gay community as well as the lesbian, bisexual. I mean, it's very common.
Very common.
But did you know that then? And how much did finding a community become a part of this, wanting to talk to other people?
Well, it wasn't until about maybe a year or two ago that I started really becoming conscious about finding a community. I mean, I had always had that in the back of my mind, like when I was going through treatment, because when I was in treatment both times, I was the only male. And I could relate to the girls that I was in treatment with about several things, but other things I couldn't relate to, like losing their menstrual cycle and other things like that. Like, I was never able to relate to that kind of stuff. And I never wasn't until later in life that I had been really wanting a community, but it was something that I've always been thinking about.
Well, we asked because, again, the National Eating Disorders Association points out that a sense of connectedness to the gay community is related to fewer eating disorders. In other words, if you find that community, it almost becomes protective. Have you felt that way?
I actually have not. Mm. And there's not a really a big gay community in the area that I live in. So that's another thing that's been really tough for me is finding a sense of community. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's just not, it doesn't exist in my world.
Right, in your world. And how much, I mean, what would you say to the gay community? Because this is a conversation that's been going on within the gay community, I understand, outside of eating disorders, that there needs to be more acceptance of different body types and different looks.
Right. And I would sort of say it's something we need to embrace in the queer community, especially among gay men, because we're all so concerned about our bodies and how they look. And also I want to comment that there is societal pressure from heteronormative society that they want us to look a certain way and be a certain way and act a certain way. Something else I wanted to point out too.
Yeah. It's a demand you cannot meet. Well, Zachary, how would you characterize this? Is it like an addiction? Will this be a lifelong something you have to keep an eye on? How do you feel about your eating disorders now?
Well, I still currently do struggle, but I have a therapist and a psychiatrist. It's something that I'm going to be struggling with for the rest of my life because it is very addictive because it's a way to control things internally. And that sort of control and that power that the eating disorder gives you becomes very addictive.
And here's the part that this may be very, very uncomfortable for people, but just, you know, so people aren't, you know, don't walk away from this thinking, oh, you know, the guy was eating lettuce a lot. Were you being sick? Were you taking laxatives? I mean, how bad was it?
So I actually wasn't purging. I was just strictly restricting. But I will say when I went into treatment the first time, I was 5'10 and 104 pounds to kind of give you an idea of where I was.
5'10 and 104 pounds?
Yes. And I wanted to get into the 90s was my goal. So I was at that time, I was very sick.
Yeah. Zachary Whitney, thank you so much for speaking with us, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
Writer Sherry Turkle studies how we communicate. So how are the women in the Democratic debates doing?
Are you trying to say that I'm dumb? Or are you mocking me here, Pete?
All of those women from those non-disclosure agreements, so we can hear their side of the story?
Next time, Here and Now.